Less than 3 weeks until early voting begins in Texas, and already some numbers are in. Registration shattering records. What that adds up to today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown, Jeremy Wallace of the Houston Chronicle, with more on voter registration records being set, what it tells us and what it doesn't when it comes to election outcomes. Also, decriminalizing homelessness 1 year on after a change in laws in the Texas capital city. How much of a difference is it making, and are other Texas cities following suit? Also, far fewer cars on Texas roadways. Why aren't traffic fatalities far fewer, too? Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Among the stories we're tracking, a much-discussed vote on moving the Alamo Cenotaph. A state historical review panel voting against relocating a monument to the 200 Alamo defenders, rejecting a proposal from the city of San Antonio. More on that in the Texas Roundup a little later in the broadcast. On this 23rd of September, we are now just 20 days away from the first Texas ballots being cast in this year's general election. With a pandemic, a closer-than-expected presidential contest in the Lone Star State, if you trust the polls, a vacancy in the Supreme Court turning the spotlight on the U.S. Senate, and a hotly contested race in Texas, by the way, and with enough Texas House races in play that there could be an historic power shift in Austin. Well, this promises to be a general election year like few others in Texas history. And so where do we stand? With just a little less than 3 weeks to go before early voting, Texans are already making election year history, setting new records for voter registration. With so many considering that the stakes could not get much higher, this may or may not come as much of a surprise. A headline in the Houston Chronicle: Texas shatters voter registration records again as Trump-Biden election draws closer. Reporter Jeremy Wallace wrote this story, and he covers politics for the Chronicle. Jeremy, welcome back to the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
When you say the state's shattering voter registration records, by how many registered voters are we talking about here? And how many total registered voters does that make in Texas?
Well, we've hit 16.6 million registered voters now in Texas, a little bit more than that. That gives us 1.5 million voters added just since the 2016 presidential election. So, you know, even since the pandemic hit, we've added 400,000 just since March.
Are there certain areas of the state where these numbers appear to be spiking? Or, I mean, what can you make of these numbers in the aggregate?
Well, in some of my earlier reporting this summer, it's like what we were able to see was that like about a third of all those new registrations have been coming from Bexar County, Travis County, and Harris County. You know, three pretty blue areas of the state, which has certainly caused for Democrats to think, hey, maybe things are going their way. But at the same time, we're also seeing like the higher than the normal, you know, state, you know, increase in places like Hayes County, Williamson County, in Montgomery County. These are all suburban communities outside of big metro areas. And so in those areas, they think that suburban growth might actually help them when it comes down to November 3rd.
I guess so. And that would have been perhaps the conventional wisdom before 2018, when it seemed like a lot of suburbs were moving more in the Democratic columns. And that raised a lot of concern, certainly among a lot of Republicans. But I'm curious now, since we can't know how these voters will cast their ballot come Election Day, what are experts telling you about how higher voter registration numbers are likely to play out in the fall? How does the conventional wisdom that this generally benefits Democrats, how does that hold?
You know, actually, the conventional wisdom tells us newly registered voters are some of the worst voters. You know,
is that right?
It's hard to get them out to vote. If you registered somebody back in the summer, trying to keep them engaged and getting them out to vote is one of the hardest things that campaigns have to do. And campaigns traditionally have, you know, those first-time voters, they don't want to mess with registering voters because they know how hard it is to get them out. But what we saw in 2018, it kind of threw some of it on its ear. In 2018, you know, and a lot of people look back at the Beto O'Rourke U.S. Senate campaign, mm-hmm. they registered a lot new voters. And then we saw a shocking voter turnout in some places. You know, I look at some place like Hayes County, which had this enormous voter turnout on election day that nobody kind of expected. And one of the prevailing pieces of wisdom was that those new registered voters came out to vote at a higher number than we're used to seeing. 2018 tells us that people were far more motivated. And in the political atmosphere we're in right now, those newly registered voters, maybe for both Democrats and Republicans, are more fired up than ever.
That's interesting. But of course, there's the pandemic factor, right? I mean, are they going to be coming out to actually vote, and how many are going to be doing, say, early voting? How many are going to do mail-in ballots and that sort of thing?
Yeah, in Texas, you know, since not everybody can mail in vote, you know, we've seen the courts have stepped in and stopped the state from trying to expand that too much further. You know, how that coronavirus affects people's psyche when they go to vote is going to be interesting to see. Like, you know, because that first day of early voting, I can guarantee you, whoever you are, you're going to be in line.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are really fired up to vote on that first day of early voting, the last day of early voting, and of course on November 3rd.
Jeremy, the bottom line here, I think, for a lot of listeners is, okay, so who wins with this news that there are more voters? And you were talking about how we're seeing major voter registration in some of the larger metropolitan areas in Texas, and that would suggest that Democrats are going to be the key beneficiaries of this move. So is that the conventional wisdom, that Democrats stand to win more here, at least based on what the experts are telling you?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And I think, you know, I think U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, you know, was on a conference call with, you know, some of his supporters just the other day where he said, look, guys, these Democrats are coming out even stronger than ever. This is a battleground. So I think just in that context, it's clear that what we've seen in Texas is something we're just not used to seeing, right? And so there's so many more people active and engaged and ready to go vote. And this is going to be a closer race than almost anybody's seen in their lifetime in Texas in a presidential cycle.
Jeremy Wallace reports on state politics for the Houston Chronicle. Jeremy, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, David.
You may have thought evictions were on hold in Texas since the CDC issued a national moratorium. But in the Houston area alone this week, there are 600 eviction cases on court dockets. One frustrated Houston City Council member has tried to draft an ordinance to slow things down. As Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports, the Texas Supreme Court has stepped in to offer more rules, but it's still unclear what that means for many people who could lose their homes.
Houston leads the country in the number of evictions since the pandemic started. Landlords here have filed over 11,000 cases since mid-March. And with no state or local protections in place, a national eviction order from the CDC promised some relief. When it came out, Houston at-large Councilmember Letitia Plummer says she was elated, but quickly realized it wouldn't stop all evictions in Justice of the Peace courts, or JP courts.
The JP courts specifically are really making decisions based on their own mindset for every individual case, which really makes it difficult, especially because a lot of people really don't know what their rights are, and so they can't challenge whatever the decision is made in court.
A Houston Public Media review of eviction cases found only one out of 100 cases was stopped during the first week of the CDC moratorium. That's why Plummer planned to bring an ordinance to City Council to make sure renters had all the information they needed.
We're all waiting for someone else to give us the answer. And we have a lot of control in our municipal government to make some solid decisions.
But then the Texas Supreme Court issued an emergency order addressing a lot of the gray areas Plummer had raised. Harris County Justice of the Peace Jeremy Brown says renters and landlords weren't the only people hoping for clarity. He had questions about what to do with the order in his court, too.
One of the things that I was wrestling with before the order was how much information should I give tenants who come through the court about the CDC order?
The Texas Supreme Court answered that. If they want to, judges can tell renters in the courtroom about their rights under the CDC order. And now, when renters get a written citation from a local court, it also has to include that extra information. and a copy of a form to stop the eviction.
So now on our new citation specifically, it's going to have information about the CDC order.
Brown says the new guidance could help many renters, but he believes the majority will still likely fall through the cracks. Last year, 60% of renters didn't show up at his court for their eviction hearing. Many leave as soon as they get a notice to vacate, afraid to get involved with the legal system. Other big states like New York, California, and Illinois have statewide eviction moratoriums in effect, so they're not really happening anyway. Brown says he'd prefer it if the Texas Supreme Court had issued a real moratorium last week, instead of just clarifying guidance on the CDC order. But he's not surprised.
Texas treats housing as a commodity. When you treat housing as a commodity more so than actual right, these are the collateral consequences.
Meanwhile, others worry the latest Texas Supreme Court order actually could make it harder for renters to stop their eviction. That's because under the CDC order, a renter has to give a signed declaration form to their landlord. But now in Texas, a renter also has to file that form with the court, at least in cases where an eviction lawsuit is already pending or has been filed. Donna Carney, an attorney with Lone Star Legal Aid, says that creates a new obstacle.
We have evidence of that because of the low percentage of tenants who participate in their own defense, and certainly the abysmally low number of tenants who are represented by counsel, where the concern is that tenants will not know how to file the declarative statement into the court record.
Carney and others say there's still a lot to clear up as Harris County courts move forward, including how to enforce any violations if the landlord breaks the rules. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring social media on this Wednesday. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about that surge in voter registrations y'all were talking about at the top of the show. And on the Texas Standard Facebook page, folks are sounding off and sharing their plans on how they're going to vote. Ellen Edmondson says she will vote early to avoid the crowds, although as y'all were discussing, maybe some crowds there on that first day of early voting. Gibby Timlett says, you're damned right, I'll be there. Meanwhile, Craig Hartley says this about what the election may look like. He says it's going to get ugly this year. I'm voting early. Be sure you are registered and do everything right. Remember, in his words, the GOP is pulling out all the stops to block the wrong voters. And Catherine Carlson says this about that surge in registrations. Now, if they will just go vote, echoing that issue that we have seen in past elections there, David, will they actually turn out? Well, that's just what some folks are saying about that one story where we tackled earlier. I'll be back with more stories from social later in the program.
Indeed, we would love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And as we say, Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is looking for you. He's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes or so as the Texas Standard continues. We are coming up on 19 minutes past the hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas's capital city often moves a little differently than the rest of the state. As with recent city measures to reduce police spending, those moves can get the negative attention of state officials, Republicans in particular. A little over a year ago, it wasn't police spending, but ordinances affecting people who are homeless that were making headlines. Austin basically rolled back measures that punish people for camping in public spaces. The governor wasn't so happy about that, and there was also some community pushback. The coronavirus and other big stories have taken the spotlight off of Austin's laws surrounding homelessness, but the issue hasn't gone away. Gus Bova is still paying attention to it. He's a reporter for the Texas Observer. Gus, good to talk with you again, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's true the headlines lately have largely been focused elsewhere, but what about the controversy over Austin's moves regarding homelessness? They've not gone away altogether, right?
Yeah, for sure. Some of the things that were driving a lot of the media cycle around it have died down. The governor isn't sending so many tweets anymore, for example, but there were still a number of relevant news stories. Recently, there was this group involving the local police union and the Republican Party that nearly got a ballot initiative on the November ballot to restore the old criminalization policies. The Austin suburb of Leander just passed a camping ban. And then, of course, we'll wait to see whether the governor follows through on his promise to do something in the next legislative session.
A little more than a year in, what do the numbers tell us when it comes to the effect of the changes that Austin City Council made last year?
What you hear consistently is that that policy change last year did provide a sort of a degree of relief and safety in people's lives, that basically people who were hiding in flood zones, people who were hiding in creeks or wooded areas or so forth, were able to come out to these highway underpasses, for instance, where there's more visibility. There's actually a bit of a breeze to keep you cool during the summer. There's rain protection and so forth. There is a consistently reported sort of concrete benefit to these policies, being able to have a tent as well. The numbers, on the other hand, are tricky. The yearly count of the homeless, which is done on a certain night in January, showed an 11% jump over the prior year. However, the group that did the count argues that it was easier to find people, and also there were more volunteers because of the increased political attention. So they'd say they're counting more of an already existing population.
In the national scheme of things, where is Austin now in this process of redefining its relationship with people who are experiencing homelessness, and what are the next hurdles?
I think I would circle back to the question of housing, that Austin has this real housing crunch and shortage for folks at the bottom. There's 14 affordable units available for every 100 extremely poor individuals. When you go back, this camping ban was passed in 1996, and in 1997, I found a memo from city staff to city council saying, we've issued 2,000 citations, no one's showing up to court, we have been somewhat successful in scattering people from the downtown area, which was the goal, but we're getting increased complaints from other residential areas or green belt areas or wooded areas because the people don't disappear.
What about the rest of the state? Has any other city looked at Austin and made similar changes?
No, decidedly not. Some listeners might recall that when Austin passed a paid sick leave ordinance, that San Antonio and Dallas followed in Austin's footsteps. The bag ban happened in a few cities around Texas, but on this issue of homeless ordinances, even though Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, all these cities have similar laws to what Austin had, none of them have seriously looked at changing them. And look at the police funding question now. Austin made a cut, and Houston and San Antonio both raised their budgets. So it is interesting the way that Austin is finding itself on a bit of an island.
Gus Bova writes for the Texas Observer. We'll link to his story on the year since Austin decriminalized homelessness at texasstandard.org. Gus, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We were just talking about efforts in Austin that affect people experiencing homelessness. Today, the Dallas City Council is voting on a budget that includes $12 million for homeless services, about the same amount as last year. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
Pastor Wayne Walker says the city wasn't spending enough last year on homeless services, and that was before the coronavirus pandemic started pushing people into financial ruin. Walker runs Our Calling, a faith-based homeless agency.
The number of cars that line up with people that have just become homeless and don't know where to go, or a family that's living in their car, or people that walk up is growing it by an exponential factor.
The money budgeted for the Office of Homeless Solutions will fund outreach services, shelter, and housing.
Dallas spends more money on arts and culture and more money on animal services than they do on the homeless community.
The number of people experiencing homelessness in Dallas has shot up in recent years. Carl Falconer says that in a normal year, he'd also argue the city's putting way too little into homeless services.
But given the fact that this year, really, we're looking at cuts to the budget, flat is okay with us for right now.
Falconer leads the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, which coordinates homeless organizations. He says the city's also able to lean on the $34 million of federal money it received from coronavirus aid packages to help people who are experiencing homelessness. Congress sent money to help people at risk of losing their housing as well.
That's one of the reasons why flat at the city budget is kind of okay, I guess, at this point.
In addition, the city will get another $12 million in state and federal grant funds for homelessness. City Councilmember Chad West chairs the Committee on Housing and Homelessness. He says the city is thinking more ambitiously these days. But this year,
we have challenges right now with a reduced sales tax. It's going to be even worse in 2021-22. I don't think this is the year to be sinking all of the city's resources into one area. I think you've got to just keep everything sustained as we see what our COVID recovery looks like.
Even so, West says there are bright spots in the budget. There's a new $650,000 program to divert people picked up for public intoxication into addiction treatment instead of jail. About one in five people arrested for public intoxication are homeless. The city will also begin purchasing old hotels to use as medium-term housing for the homeless. And West says the city has a plan to end veteran homelessness within a year.
Once we see some successes from that, I get the impression that my colleagues would be more willing to kind of invest more money in that in the future. But we need to see some results first.
Beyond what's budgeted for direct homeless services, Ellen Magnus is glad to see the city trying to create more affordable housing. Even before the pandemic, 6 in 10 households were burdened by housing costs, a root cause of homelessness. Magnus is president of the nonprofit Family Gateway.
We've got decades and decades and decades of policy decisions that have, you know, contributed to this. This is a systems failure, not a people failure. These are folks who have fallen through every crack.
She says the city will need to budget more money if it's serious about ending homelessness, but money can't solve it alone. It'll also take better coordination and political will. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, reminding everyone to keep annual preventive and screening appointments. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes, so discussion with a doctor is encouraged. More at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Historical Commission last night overwhelmingly rejected the city of San Antonio's request to relocate a monument to the Alamo Defenders as part of a $450 million plan to revamp the plaza and visitor experience. The renovation plan called for moving the cenotaph about 500 feet from its current location. Commission Chairman John Now was among those who opposed the move.
The end result should be the cenotaph located where the blood flowed.
The Texas Historical Commission encouraged the San Antonio City Council to come up with an alternative to relocating the cenotaph. United States Postal Service officials say voting groups are allowed to leave registration and absentee ballot applications at post offices. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports this comes after Texas Congress members complained the groups were barred from doing so.
Members of the League of Women Voters of Texas had said the issue started last month when volunteers went into post offices in Waller County to drop off basic voter materials. Since then, members of Congress from the Houston area sent a letter to the USPS raising concerns about those volunteers being turned away. In response, USPS officials said they are directing their workers to allow the placement of voter registration forms and absentee ballot request forms in the post office box lobbies of retail facilities, effective immediately. Texas doesn't have online voter registration, so voters are often directed to pick up physical registration forms at government buildings like post offices. Because of the pandemic, libraries and schools haven't been available to voters. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Democrats are currently 9 seats away from flipping the Texas House in November. State Representative Celia Israel of Austin says that means her party needs to make sure they're keeping voters engaged.
So we need to be prepared to take advantage of the political winds that are coming.
But Beaumont Republican Dade Phelan thinks the GOP will maintain control of the lower chamber.
Back in July, I would have had a difficult time coming on here and honestly saying that we're going to keep control of the House. But thankfully, the election was not in July. It's going to be in November. And things have certainly changed over the last 6 to 8 weeks.
State Representatives Israel and Phelan spoke during the Texas Tribune Festival Tuesday. And several Texans are among Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2020. Platinum-selling Houston rapper Megan Thee Stallion won accolades for her innovative lyricism. Air Force Chief of Staff Charles Q. Brown Jr., who's from San Antonio, also made the list. He's the first black person to lead a U.S. military service. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the University of Texas at Dallas, where nearly 30,000 students strive for academic rigor, career focus, and social opportunities. More at utdallas.edu/bright. UT Dallas, moving at the speed of bright.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. If you've been on the road lately, you may have noticed those TxDOT billboards that count the number of people who died on Texas's roads and highways during the year. In 2019, it was 3,610. But 2020, of course, has been a different year. So few cars and trucks on the road because of the pandemic, you'd expect that number to be way down. So, why is Texas at more than 2,000 traffic fatalities with numbers for the last 4 to 5 months yet to come? Robert Wunderlich has wondered why, too. He studies transportation safety. In fact, he is the director of the Center for Transportation Safety at Texas A&M Transportation Institute. Robert, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David.
How do you explain this phenomenon? An unusual year because of COVID, fewer cars than we've had in decades on Texas roads, and yet close to the same number of deaths as in a typical year, at least so far?
Well, we've seen two phenomena. One, overall crashes. They're down considerably, pretty much in proportion to the amount of travel reductions. But we did not see the same thing happening for fatalities.
Why would that be?
Well, normally you would think that all of that would be proportional. The less people traveling, you'd have about the less proportion of fatal and injury and property damage only. The biggest contributor to crash severity is speed. And we started looking around the state. And what you find is that during the periods where normally you'd have congestion and people would be driving maybe 40, 45 miles an hour, mm-hmm. those speeds have risen to 60 and 65. The thing about speed is that it's an exponential function, so that a 10% increase in speed can be over a 50% increase in severity,
wow.
particularly in terms of fatal crashes.
Does the correlation between speed and fatalities, how rigid is that? Does an increase in speed necessarily mean we're going to see an increase in traffic fatalities?
Well, there, traffic crashes and traffic fatalities are a very complex subject. As vehicles get safer, and they have been getting safer for many years, mm-hmm. The ability to withstand some of the forces in a crash have improved. But in general, the relationship between severity and speed is pretty well documented in research.
Now, every year, states set goals in terms of fatalities, such as to have a day without a single fatality, Vision Zero, or to have a max of, say, this year, I think the goal set by Texas was to have a max of 728 fatalities in 2020. Why, in a year like 2020, when fewer cars are on the road, why even then were those goals unattainable? Or are those unrealistic expectations in the first place? How do you see it?
Well, I think the goal is correct. We don't really want anyone to die just because they're traveling. But it's very challenging to reduce that. I mean, the biggest influencing factor on the number of fatalities is the number of people driving and the miles that they drive. We're in a state that has been enjoying economic prosperity. We've got a lot of growth. People are moving into the state. More people and more people traveling are going to mean more crashes and probably more fatalities. What we're trying to do is reduce the risk side. And there's lots of good ways that we can do it. Some are on the engineering side, but people have to take a responsibility themselves about buckling up, by not being impaired, by staying alert. So there's a role for everybody to play.
I wonder.
And one of the challenges. Yes, go
forgive
ahead.
Forgive me for interrupting, but are there still a lot of people not buckling up despite the massive media campaign and the threat of tickets and that sort of thing?
Well, that's an interesting question. We find in the urban areas that seatbelt use is over 90%, but it's kind of been stuck there for a while. There's still sort of this reluctant 8-9% of people that don't want to wear it in the urban areas. And when you get in the rural areas, that percentage goes down. It also goes down for nighttime driving, which is unfortunate because that's when we have a lot of our single vehicle run off the road crashes. About 40 to 50% of the people who die in vehicle crashes are not belted.
You know, as people look at the lack of congestion, I think a lot of people sort of imagine a world where you didn't have so much cars. You have the congestion problem solved, and they sort of figure, well, maybe we could deal with the large number of fatalities that we have on the highways. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the lessons that we're kind of seeing from this is that if we solve the congestion problem, if we don't solve at the same time the problem with people running into one another or running off the road, then we're going to have a higher rate per person traveling of severe crashes and fatalities. It's not going to be the panacea that we thought it might be.
Robert C. Wunderlich is the director of the Center for Transportation Safety at Texas A&M Transportation Institute. Mr. Wunderlich, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard, and drive safe.
Thanks, and you do too.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Until earlier this year, Fort Worth was the biggest city in Texas without a form of outside police oversight. Now, police monitor Kim Neal, who's been on the job for 6 months, a time that's largely coincided with nationwide protests over police actions. From KERA North Texas, Miranda Suarez talked with Neal about her time in office so far and with others about their continued concerns over police accountability.
Kim Neal was still settling in to her new job as police monitor when a Minneapolis officer killed George Floyd. Protests exploded across the country.
We immediately did a soft launch of our office, even though we weren't ready, but we did a soft launch because we wanted people to feel like they had a voice in the community.
Demonstrators in Fort Worth had no trouble raising that voice. As they protested, they carried signs in honor of a Tatiana Jefferson, a Black woman killed by a white Fort Worth police officer last year. Kim Neal comes to Texas from Ohio, where she was head of police oversight in Cincinnati.
My city manager in Cincinnati used to joke with me all the time because, you know, if it was up to me, civilian oversight was the most important thing. It was like it was more important than the health department. Oh, who cares about health?
In Cincinnati, Neal's office investigated the police department's actions. Her job in Fort Worth is different. She keeps an eye on how the police department handles its own investigations into complaints, but doesn't open any of her own. Her office collects and analyzes data about the department and then makes recommendations for policy changes. Neal says her goal is to improve the relationship between the community and the police. She says events like the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, have made it clear just how important that is.
Just because they're happening in Wisconsin or they're happening in Minneapolis or Louisville, Kentucky, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean it's not going to happen here. So we just always have to be ready and prepared to take that on. And we've got to stop being reactive and be more proactive.
Neal's office has reviewed over 100 citizen complaints so far, and she says the police have accepted all of her recommendations, like adopting a system that will allow her to track complaints as they move through the department. But some activists want more. Pamela Young with the group United Fort Worth wants the city to establish a community oversight board made up of regular people.
No one knows better what is wrong and what needs to be changed than Black people in Fort Worth and brown people in Fort Worth and poor people in Fort Worth.
In a perfect world, Young says, Neal and her assistant would work directly with the Community Oversight Board. And Neal likes the idea of a board, but won't make her recommendation about what it should look like until next month. Activist Dante Williams says he doesn't understand why they're still waiting.
Because as we wait, you know, more things are going to happen.
And the community is still going to feel like they're at a disadvantage to getting justice.
Williams is the president of Community Frontline, a group that works in East Fort Worth. He wishes Neal had the power to compel officers to talk to her, which she can't. And because she can only make recommendations, she can't force the police to do anything. Benga Ajilori is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. He's studied police oversight and is skeptical about how much impact a police monitor can actually have without decision-making power.
They have to follow recommendations. So if an officer kills someone and it was deemed that it was unauthorized, extrajudicial, then there should be a way to make that officer and that agency accountable. And if not, there's no reason for the agency to change their behavior, and therefore oversight is meaningless.
The city does have some built-in layers of accountability. For example, the police chief isn't the only boss of the department. He has to report to an assistant city manager. But one shakeup on its way is Chief Ed Krause's upcoming retirement. Kim Neal says it's unlikely that the city will hire a new chief who is totally opposed to working with her. And she believes in her power to make a difference regardless.
I have faith in it, yes. If I didn't, I probably wouldn't be here.
And she still feels that way, even after 6 tumultuous months on the job. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
New countries don't come and go very often, but when they do, one inevitable task is the designation of an official flag. After all, can you think of any countries or states, for that matter, without a flag to advertise its existence? But when it comes to flag design, Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong notes some seem to do it better than others.
I'm proud to tell you that according to Ted Kaye, one of the world's leading vexillologists, a fancy word for one who studies flags, the Texas flag is the best-selling of all the state flags. It also rates almost perfect in artistic design. That's the conclusion of one landmark study by the North American Vexillological Association. Try saying that after 3 beers at sea. The study rated all national, state, and territorial flags of North America and found that only New Mexico's flag had a just smidgen better design than the Texas flag. Ted Kaye says that these are the 5 rules of good design. Number 1, keep it simple. So simple a child can draw it from memory. Use meaningful symbolism. Use 2 to 3 basic colors, no more than 3. No lettering, no words. The design should speak for itself. Do you hear it saying Lone Star State? Yep. And finally, your design should be distinctive. Not only is the Texas flag the best-selling state flag, it is also displayed more in all its forms than any other state flag. Drive down any neighborhood in Texas and you will see the flag flying proudly in the Texas breeze on 30 and 40-foot poles in many a yard. It's displayed from wall mounts on porches or over garages. You will see it over car dealerships and on top of skyscrapers and cities in the countryside. You'll see it at the entrance to farms and ranches, perhaps with the stars and stripes next to it. It's at the beach, fluttering and snapping smartly behind 4-wheel drive pickups, or on boats, and at makeshift campsites, and even over children's forts in the woods. It's painted on barns. You can't drive very far in rural Texas without seeing a barn flag. Never seen a Nebraska barn flag. I see many a Texas flag painted on gates, too. Beautiful. Never seen a Michigan flag gate. And though it's not the same, I'd like to point out that we're the only state with our own toast. There's no Oregon toast. There's no Florida-shaped waffle makers, either. Yes, the Texas flag is everywhere. T-shirts, swimsuits, towels, bikinis, boots, belt buckles, earrings, and tattoos. And if it's not a flag, we have the Texas Star as a stand-in on the side of our houses, hanging on the wall in the kitchen, or on the apron we're barbecuing with. I have even seen a Texas Star barbecue grill cover. John Steinbeck pointed out that the deep love and commitment Texans have for their state closely approximates that of a religion. Based on the affection we have for our symbols, it seems that we are an extraordinarily devout people. As this is radio, I can't end with the flag, but I can play Willie, You can hear Texas in his voice. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
No place but Texas. When I ever roam.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can find his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org and wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that his office indicted someone in Texas for fraudulently casting 1,700 ballots. Is that a fact? Here to sort out fact from fiction, Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Hey, David.
So where did Attorney General Barr make this claim?
So Barr said this during an interview he did on CNN, and he was trying to make the case that voting by mail is fraught with the risk of fraud and coercion. And to highlight those problems, he was pointing to this case in Texas. And the statement that he made prompted a lot of social media posts also that have been circulating and repeating this information. So we really wanted to make sure that we got in here and did some fact checking. And he said exactly what you indicated earlier, and I'm quoting here. We indicted someone in Texas, 1,700 ballots collected from people who could vote. He made them out and voted for the person he wanted to.
Now, we should note that there has been quite the back and forth on the left and the right about just how frequent voter fraud actually is, how common this is. And that's part of the backdrop here. So against that backdrop, did someone in Texas actually get indicted for fraudulently casting 1,700 ballots?
So the case that Barr was talking about here is a real case from Texas in 2017. Prosecutors in Dallas County that year were investigating some suspected mail-in voter fraud. They got a tip that there were voters who had not requested mail ballots, who then were getting notices that they would be receiving those ballots, because that's how you vote by mail in Texas. You have to apply and request a ballot, and then the state will send it to you. Mm-hmm. And what investigators found was that there was one name that appeared on over 700 ballots. It was Jose Rodriguez. And that name was written in the space on the ballot that lets you indicate whether somebody helped you complete the ballot. And one of the county attorneys who worked on the case said that investigators then contacted each of those 700 voters. Mm-hmm. And they said that the ballots actually were legitimate and they cast them for the candidate they supported. And this individual helped them fill it out.
Now, let me make sure that I understand what happened here. There was an indictment or there was not an indictment, just an investigation. Where does that aspect of the claim stand?
So there was an investigation and one suspect was ultimately arrested, but it was in a slightly different facet of the investigation. So this individual was accused and pled guilty of forging a woman's signature on a mail-in ballot request for a city election in Dallas. So he did violate the law here, but it wasn't for actually casting the ballot. It was for requesting the ballot for that individual then to cast. And I'll say that this 1,700 number that Barr is talking about, it didn't come from nowhere. A prosecutor in the case said that investigators did initially suspect that there were as many as 1,700 fraudulent ballots cast, mm-hmm. but they were not able to uncover any kind of fraud and any fraud of that magnitude.
That's very interesting. So we had a guilty plea in this case, but it didn't occur the way that Attorney General Barr stated or claimed that it happened. Is that what you discovered?
That's exactly right. And the Justice Department has since said that Barr was misstating the facts here because he was given a memo from the department before his interview on CNN, and that memo inaccurately described the case at hand.
Is it clear just how many
ballots may have been or should have been discounted as fraudulent in this case, or were there any actually, ultimately speaking?
So the actual ballots that they investigated, those were all cast legitimately by voters. The issue here that resulted in arrest was the request for a ballot, not the ballot itself.
Okay. So now, given this background, what about a ruling?
We rated this claim from Barr false.
False. U.S. Attorney General William Barr's claim that someone in Texas was indicted for fraudulently casting 1,700 ballots. That ruling from the fact checkers at PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, good to speak with you.
Great speaking with you.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor here at The Standard. Wells, what are you seeing out there on this
weekend? Howdy, David. Well, continuing to hear from folks out there about that historic surge in voter registrations here in Texas, and folks expressing their thoughts about that in some rather unique ways. For me, I like this comment on the Texas Standard Facebook page from one Heather Soden, who offers a haiku. She writes, "Overcome the graft, clear a pathway to health. Vote, 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 vote." So obviously lots of folks fired up and ready to go when it comes to voting this election season. Shifting gears, hearing from folks about another story earlier in the program, that interesting decision regarding the cenotaph at the Alamo in San Antonio. And this vote, I believe it was 12-2, quite the vote against moving it. So lots of folks registering their shock and surprise and comments on this one. This one also via Facebook, Gabriel Gonzalez says he was okay with moving it to that new location, noting that the monument was not part of the original Alamo and that they wouldn't be getting rid of it, just moving it to what he called a better location. And similarly, a comment via Twitter from Ida Golankazi. She says while she wasn't a fan of the redevelopment, she appreciated that interview we had last week on the show with the gentleman who is in charge of some aspects of this $450 million, I believe, plan to redevelop the area around the Alamo. She wrote that she saw the expense of moving the cenotaph, or rather not moving it, would be problematic since so much money had been invested in that redevelopment plan. She says she thought it made sense to move it, but again, that has not come to pass. And also got some emails from some other listeners. Don't have them in front of me, but it was very interesting from some folks in San Antonio, the gist of which was, you know, this was going to be a very pretty plan, but it would cut off some access for San Antonians who are used to, driving in close proximity to the Alamo. So I think that may be one concern that people sort of played down or didn't really consider as much. But again, quite the surprising decision there.
Just for those who've never, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add one last interesting aspect of this worth mentioning is our own Michael Marks, who spent a little time in San Antonio, right, lived there previously. He's done some reporting on these issues, and he has a very interesting thread that we retweeted on the Texas Standard Twitter account talking about how the cenotaph put there in 1936, I believe, was part of the Texas Centennial, which was this really concerted effort to sort of push the Texas identity as one of more independence from Mexico rather than its involvement in the Confederacy, and so how the cenotaph plays into that and the sort of cultural politics of that moment. Very interesting thing that folks can see on our Twitter page, Texas Standard.
.org. Absolutely. It's an important thing to consider, especially when you take into account the history behind that cenotaph and the prominent place that it has there on that plaza. And if you've never been there to the plaza, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We're out of time, but we hope you will visit us over at texasstandard.org. And of course, we hope you will join Wells Dunbar, myself, and the rest of the team here tomorrow.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.